For the week of June 27th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 60, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And on the corner of 49th Avenue and Vernon Boulevard in Long Island City, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're still outside. Did you at least get inside?
No, I'm under an overhang. It's raining. I don't have internet because I'm in an apartment where I'm subletting it to new people. All the cafes are too noisy, so I'm standing on a street corner yet again.
Yet again. Okay, so last week you were on a street corner. This week you're on a street corner, but at least you're still in Long Island City.
That's right.
Okay, so if there's any audio issues, we'll blame them all on Michael. Certainly, we can't blame him for a lack of news to talk about. There's a ton of entertainment news this week. We're going to be talking about, of course, box office we'll start off with in a moment. We're going to be talking about what's going on with the movie box office futures trading and whether it has a hope of succeeding now that the financial reform bill has passed Congress. We're also going to talk about some Academy Awards news, not any awards being handed out, but instead when the awards will actually be held and who will be producing them. In television, we're going to be talking about Jay Leno, but not for long. In music, we have some news about music festivals, Lollapalooza, Lilith Fair, even Glastonbury, which is being held right now. We'll, of course, do our lightning round Big Deal or Big Whoop. Later on in the episode, we're going to be talking with Mattea Gold during Inside Baseball, who wrote a very interesting article with Richard Verrier. She's from the Los Angeles Times. She wrote an article about child slavery in Hollywood, something like that. I like the way Michael unmutes himself to laugh at my corny joke.
Trying to show support.
Okay, yeah. I was like, wow, crickets. Well, we should turn it over to Michael, who will fill us in on the box office, not only here in North America, but all over the world. Michael, take it away.
Well, there are four big movies at the box office this week. To keep it simple, I'm working up from four to number one. The Karate Kid made $15 million. Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz in Night and Day made $20 million. Grown Ups, the Adam Sandler Chris Rock comedy, made about $40 million, and Toy Story 3, for its second week in a row at number one, made about $60 million. So it's a good week at the box office. Toy Story 3 is unbelievably good. Everyone I know who sees it cries. Everybody loves it. It made $60 million this weekend. It's made $226 million total. It hasn't really opened wide overseas yet. That's coming. There's a lot of talk about, well, it's going to lose 3D screens some next week and more the week after that. And what will that do? Is it all, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, people are going to see this in 2D, 3D, 4D, whatever. It's going to make a lot of money. I didn't see it again. I did see Night and Day, which wasn't the worst thing in the world.
Really?
What movies did you guys see this weekend?
I did see Toy Story 3. Of course, I'd seen it in 2D. It was a work print or a working version of it. And I have to say, it was just as good, if not better, in 3D. And like you said, Michael, everybody in the theater was crying at the end. It's a great movie, and it really entertained the kids.
I may have to cave and actually see Toy Story 3. I hear really good things about it.
It's really worth it.
Well, it won't mean as much not having seen 1 and 2.
I've seen 1 and 2.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, well, then you're set up. At the beginning, it's a little repetitive. You feel like it's the same old thing, but then it really hits it, has a great action scenes. It's very moving, you know? What are you going to do? And, you know, the other movies were just, you know, Grown Ups. I didn't see this. I had no interest in seeing it. It was like everybody from Saturday Night Live from the early 90s, except for Chris Farley. They had Kevin James in the role of Chris Farley, I guess. That made $40 million, just proving what a draw Adam Sandler is in a dumb, broad comedy like this.
I thought the billboards for that, though, were hysterical.
Them going down the water slide?
No, the billboards with them as kids.
Yes, that was very smart. Yeah. The photos of them as high school or grade school kids. Very clever. Good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with you, Michael. This movie got abysmal reviews. I have no interest in seeing it whatsoever. There is no urgency for me to see this movie. However, I do think it will do well on DVD since most of these guys started in television.
Yeah, it doesn't follow, but is it R-rated? Is it PG-13? What is it?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I just had so little interest in seeing it. I'm not sure. I think it must be PG-13, I would think. But, yeah, so that would count, I guess, as a family film in a way. Sort of an adult-leaning family film, I think.
Well, and I guess the big box office news this week was the fact that Tom Cruise did not open Night and Day. It opened to $20 million, and it made $12 million overseas. $12.6 million overseas in 12 different territories. So, you know, everybody's waiting for Tom Cruise's big career comeback, and this was supposed to be it, and I guess not.
Well, again, he's a huge draw overseas. So, I mean, I'm sure this movie, I don't know what its budget is, but I'm sure it'll make, you know, $200 million easily overseas. It's a big, broad action film that should work well overseas. So, you know, who knows? Let's see how it plays out.
Now,
again, you know, the opening weekend numbers, it wasn't a disaster. It made $20 million. And, you know, if you pay him $20 million, it should open to $20 million. That's my rule of thumb. So we'll see. But he's certainly not as big a star as Jaden Smith. The Karate Kid has made $135 million in the U.S. I think that's Jackie Chan's biggest film in the U.S. I think it's bigger than Rush Hour. And it's sure to do really well overseas with those stars and the setting of China. And that's a massively successful hit. $135 million so far for a $40 million budget. And all the rest are just sort of holdovers. The A-Team, Get Him to the Greek, Shrek Forever After, Prince of Persia, Killers, and Jonah Hex, which is really the dog of the last few weeks.
Have you seen how much money Prince of Persia has made overseas?
Well, it's made $226 million overseas, so that's about $300 million total, which means it's not going to, no one's going to lose their shirt over it. I mean, it was a very expensive film. It cost, I think, about $200 million to make. So it needed to make like $400 million just to break even worldwide. So it's you know, it's at $300 million now, so it's going to be all right. But and of course, you know, where everybody's waiting for next week, Toy Story 3 opened to $100 million. Obviously, Twilight Eclipse is going to open at $100 million as well. It's just how big it is going to be. And here's the big shock. I put in Big Deal, Big Whoop, but to heck with that. Let's do it right now. Twilight Eclipse is getting okay reviews.
Yeah, actually, a lot of the people who saw it at the premiere here in Los Angeles last week gave it rave reviews.
Well, not rave. They just said it didn't suck like the first two. I mean, that's they're saying it's a watchable movie and it's kind of fun and it's what you hoped for from the beginning. And the first two were so awful. They're not saying it's a great film. They're just saying it's finally a dumb, mindless popcorn movie as opposed to unbearably dull.
Well, I believe that you're right, Michael. I think that next week we're going to be talking about Twilight being in first place, knocking Toy Story out. It's not in 3D, though, so it won't take any of those 3D screens over. And it may not matter because there's been a lot of news recently about 3D fatigue and the percentage of each 3D film's box office take coming from 3D is dropping. The Hollywood Reporter had a story that said that over the last three animated 3D releases, starting with Alice in Wonderland, I guess it was How to Train Your Dragon, and then what was the other one? Shrek, and now Toy Story 3, they all had a decreasing percentage of their box office gross come from 3D screens. In fact, Toy Story 3 is down 11%, which must make you very happy, Karen.
It does. I feel validated. I figured, and I think we all agree, it was kind of only a matter of time before the backlash started and people realized that it wasn't necessarily worth their money, that there are certain movies that are really good in 3D and a lot of movies that aren't.
Well, and Toy Story 3 in 3D was actually pretty good.
Wasn't it Ann Thompson, though, that pointed out that we all saw Toy Story 1 and 2 not in 3D, so we didn't feel the need to see the third one in 3D.
That's a great point.
Wow. What's going on behind you, Michael?
Is there a wedding going on?
I've got chimes going on from the church across the street.
It's a funeral for 3D.
It's a funeral. The bell is tolling for 3D. It's not. People just don't want to pay $3. It doesn't matter whether the 3D is good or bad. It doesn't matter whether the color is good or bad or sound. It's like, I don't want to pay extra to see a movie. And every family film is in 3D, and that's driving parents bonkers, and it should. It's like, I don't want to shovel out an extra $9 every time I and my two kids go to a movie. You know, it's a lot of money.
People aren't as dumb as you think.
Yeah, 3D is a great way to keep us going to the movies. It's not a reason to sock it to us for higher prices. Same with the big screens and digital sound.
Yeah, and there's this big to-do over the fact that they now have 3D glasses for kids. Real D has released these, you know, child-sized 3D glasses. And I have to say, they do fit better on children under 8 than the big giant glasses, which never stayed on and the kids didn't want to keep
on. Duh, that makes sense. That's well long overdue.
But do they sit on the ears like normal glasses or are they like goggles?
No, they sit on the ears. They're just smaller versions of the larger adult version Real D glasses.
I mean, I still think that kids, you know, young kids, 3-4 years old, would really rebel against that. It's weird.
Well, you know, actually, my daughters wanted to wear sunglasses while watching a movie last week.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, she's a future Hollywood star.
Yeah, well, no, they were at home. But they, you know, they did it when they go to the movie theater, so they wanted to do it again. Yeah.
They're future 3D movie snobs, Michael.
Yes, exactly.
That's terrible.
I mean, I don't think they've ever been to a movie that hasn't been in 3D.
Okay, you have got to stop that. That's up to you. That is poor parenting.
Yeah, why aren't you taking your kids to Charlie Chaplin shorts and It's a Wonderful Life? And
yeah, they can barely sit through Toy
Story.
Why aren't
you taking them to the zoo or pony rides?
I do that.
Well, they don't have 3D glasses for that, do they?
No, I don't think so.
Will you take your kids to see The Green Hornet?
I think I probably will. Have you seen the trailer, Michael, for this The Green Hornet starring Seth Rogen? I think it's coming out in January. When I first heard about this film, I thought, what a big mistake putting Seth Rogen in basically an action comic book movie. But it looks pretty good.
I agree. I was really surprised. It doesn't look like it sucks.
Yeah, they did a good job of cutting the trailer, at least. Who knows what the film is like?
Yeah, it's a January release, and it looks. I have to say, it looks interesting, too. It looks like a good stand-up in the fall. You know, it's not one of those dumping ground movies. It definitely looks interesting.
Well, why are they releasing this in January? I guess they just have too much going on in November and December during the...
Because you should release good movies every month of the year. That's why.
And you know what? Theater owners love you for saying that. And they wish that every studio would do the same thing that... who's releasing The Green Hornet? I think it's Sony. I don't even know who it is. But it looks pretty good.
So what do you think it will gross in its opening weekend, or I guess overall, or what would you bet on it?
Oh yeah, good point. We should talk about that. I know you're leading us into the fact that Congress here in the United States, the Senate and the House, voted on a financial reform package, I guess it was Thursday, and it passed both houses. As a part of that legislation, there's a little piece in there that forbids the futures trading on box office revenue. So both of these future markets that are being started, one of which is being started by Cantor Fitzgerald, the old Hollywood Stock Exchange, they would be forbidden from operating.
But didn't that just pass?
Well, media derivatives did get approved. So, and they're hoping that they will be grandfathered in, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it's very complicated. One company thinks they've been grandfathered in. The other one is going to challenge the law as being unconstitutional. It'll go to the courts. So it's going to be a long technical legal battle ahead of us before anybody gets to bet on what the Green Hornet will gross opening weekend.
Yeah, basically this decision will leave the fate of these box office future exchanges in the hands of the courts, because both of these companies are going to sue. And it will go to court, and it will probably, I wouldn't be shocked if this goes all the way to the Supreme Court, which will affect more than box office futures. It will affect future markets for other products that are considered non-commodities.
Crickets. I can hear the crickets or the birds in the background there. No, I have nothing to say, because I am smart enough to realize how much of this is over my head. But I was surprised when it initially passed, because the whole thing seems rather... It just seems like a bad idea.
Well, the studios are against it. They've sicked the MPAA on Congress to include this language in their financial reform package. It seems like it's an earmark in a way, but apparently, you know, it made past all of the checks and balances. And
well, one of the companies has it's a real financial thing. They're like, you have to have a minimum of $5,000 to bet on, blah, blah, blah. The other one is more like gambling. But heck, I mean, overseas in England, you can bet on anything. So I'm sure you must be able to go to the corner bookie and bet on what a movie makes opening weekend.
You can.
Yeah. So, I mean, the gambling is going to come one way or another.
Well, you can certainly bet on whether a film will win an Academy Award. That's for sure. At least once it's nominated, Las Vegas takes those odds. And you don't
win.
Yeah, but none of these, and I realize where you're going with this one's segue, but none of these affect real financial markets.
No.
When you bet in Vegas, it's just for fun. I mean, it might affect, there have been arguments that it affects the way people vote, but it doesn't really affect financial markets.
But that's all these are too. They're just people betting against other people who say, I bet this movie grosses $140 million. Someone else says, I bet it doesn't, and they take your bet. That's
right.
All it is. It's not involved in financing or not financing movies or anything like that. It's just a side bet on what will happen in a market.
Right, and it's basically a futures market about how much a given commodity is worth at a specific date in time. And so if you say it's worth a dollar and at that date and time it's actually worth 50 cents, then you owe 50 cents to the person who took your bet. If it's worth $1.50, they owe you 50 cents.
Right.
Yeah, depending on what bet you make. Yeah. Anyway, but can you bet on when the Academy Awards will take place? Not just what will win, but when?
Well, actually, nowadays you probably could. The Academy announced last week that Bruce Cohen and Don Mischer will produce the 83rd Academy Awards, and it's really early for them to be announcing this kind of stuff.
I know, I immediately went to my calendar to start marking, when the Academy Awards are probably going to be, and I was like, wait a minute, what? It's June.
Yeah, well, they're going to be February 27th of 2011, and there was, I guess, an Academy board meeting last week where some interesting news kind of came out of it. They debated moving the awards to January, not for 2011, because it's way too soon to do that. They've already set the date with ABC.
Way too late.
Wait, sorry, did I say early?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's way too late to do that. The date has been set with ABC, the network broadcasting the telecast, Sunday, February 27th, live from the Kodak Theater. And so I don't know whether it would benefit the awards moving up to January. David Poland of Movie City News believes it will. Ann Thompson believes it wouldn't. And Ann Thompson
is with
IndieWire.
Can you recap what she said in her article? Because I didn't read her article, but it sounded interesting and I wasn't quite sure that I agreed.
It's a very long post on IndieWire, and she outlined a number of issues. There are eligibility issues as to when a film would be eligible. Would it still be from January to December? There's release date issues. Normally, Oscar-worthy films are released in December, and that those would all have to be moved up to November to give everybody time to see them.
Oh, yeah, that's the one that bothered me. Who cares?
Then there would be the issue of getting Academy members to see the films in a shorter period of time.
You still have a year.
Yes, although most people wait for that holiday season where they can watch all of them. Because the nominations would be in December. So instead of spending your Christmas vacation 2 weeks watching all of these films, you'd actually have to have your nominations in by the middle of December.
I've never known an Academy Award winner Academy member who waited until the Christmas season to do it. Most of the ones that I know will watch a couple of movies a week.
Anyway, it used to be in late March, early April. It felt like it took place years after all the rest of the awards had happened. You're already well into the new movie season, and they were right to move it up to February. I think moving up even more to January is probably not a good idea, but they'll figure it out.
I think that they're just concerned that there's some award fatigue by the time the Academy Awards roll around. I'd have to agree. I mean, there's the SAG Awards, there's the Golden Globes, there's...
Yeah, but all of those awards are leading up to the grand finale, which is the Academy Award.
Right, but by the time the grand finale comes around, nobody cares.
I don't think that's true at all.
Television ratings is what they're going by.
I think people don't watch the Academy Awards not because they have awards fatigue, but because the Academy Awards are well known for being, 5 hours long.
Well, and they brought Bruce Cohen and Don Mischer in. They're both very talented producers, and for Don Mischer, I mean, he's been producing award shows and television for 30 years. Who was it? I think it was Patrick Goldstein in the Los Angeles Times said that Don Mischer produced one of the episodes of Laugh-In, which was in the 60s. So this is a guy with a lot of television experience, and as Patrick Goldstein pointed out, it's about time that a television or telecast of an award show is actually produced and directed by somebody who has some experience in television, as opposed to a film producer who has no experience.
And that would be 50 years of experience if he started in the 60s.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to go back. But, he's done the Summer Olympic Games. He's done the Emmys, 15 Emmys, as a matter of fact, 10 DGA Awards shows, 2 NAACP Image Awards, and he's even won a Peabody Award for all of his work. He's done concerts with Barbara Streisand, Willie Nelson, Beyonce, Carrie Underwood. I mean, this is a guy with a lot of experience. So hopefully with someone of his ilk and experience in the technical director chair, the telecast will improve and the ratings will increase.
Yeah, he was he really started in the 70s. I just looked him up, and that Laugh-In was a one-off in the 70s. It wasn't the classic original show. I don't know what this was, but yeah, he's been around for many, many years, and it does make sense to have someone TV do it because they certainly don't know what they're doing most of the time.
Kind of like NBC. They don't seem to know what they're doing most of the time either.
I didn't understand this story at all.
Okay, that was my poor segue into television. So for those of you...
But a truthful one.
Yes. For those of you following along at home, so far we've gone through box office news, movie news. That was our Academy news. Although I guess we did skip over a bit the fact that the Academy has invited 135 new members.
They do that every year.
Yeah, they do it every year. But this year they are trying to lower the average age, and the average age is 50. They're trying to lower the average age, and they invited a whole bunch of young bucks, including everybody who was nominated last year, which is kind of a tradition that if you're nominated, then you automatically get an
invite. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean,
and they've been trying to go younger too, just like the Grammys did pretty successfully too, I might add.
Yeah. And I think, the people they invited, I wasn't too shocked that they were invited. Were you?
Give us some examples.
I knew you were going to say that. Gabourey Sidibe, for instance, in the acting
category.
Oh,
that does surprise me, actually. I mean, I know that she was nominated,
You get an invite, period.
I know.
Monique, of course, she won, so she gets in. Carey Mulligan, which is a little...
Again, nominated,
yeah.
But...
Yeah, they're all... It's what they do every year.
So let's find somebody. Ryan Reynolds, not nominated. But
oh, like Ryan Reynolds. Movies. But I don't know. He's got more movie experience than Gabourey Sidibe. I mean...
Yeah.
Zoe Saldana. From Avatar.
Star Trek and Avatar, the biggest movie of all time.
Yeah. So what? It had nothing to do with acting.
Peter Sarsgaard.
Well overdue.
Yeah, and directors, Jacques Audiard, who did A Prophet, but you know, these are all people that were nominated. So Lee Daniels was invited, again, nominated. Adam Shankman, who did Bedtime Stories and Hairspray. So
which received nominations.
So
he also produced them last year, so maybe that gives him a little something.
I was going to say, how convenient that he produced them last year. Morgan Spurlock, who was nominated way back in, I think, 2003, 2004 for Supersize Me, he was invited in under the documentary category, so that should...
Well, he should.
And Davis Guggenheim, he, of course, directed An Inconvenient Truth and It Might Get Loud, and so it's not necessarily a given that you're nominated, therefore you get in. No.
That is a given.
That is that you get nominated. If you get a nomination, you get an invite. They might have turned it down before, right. Or eventually you get an invite. That's like a rule.
Okay, so what I was saying is, if you get nominated for an Academy Award, it doesn't mean that you will be a member of the Academy. However, what you're saying is that
You will get offered. Just like if you win Wimbledon, you get offered membership at the All England Lawn Tennis Club. It's automatic.
So you're saying that to get into the All England Club, I'm going to have to win Wimbledon, or to get nominated for an Academy Award, I have to win Wimbledon? I'm confused.
All right. Let's move on.
Okay. Wow, my jokes are really bad today, huh?
Yeah, they're really not doing that well.
I'm going to have to write them down ahead of time.
Try being funny. That might work.
Wow. Well, you know who I've never really thought was very funny, and this is my second segue into the same story, so let's see how the second time goes, is Jay Leno. And apparently his audience feels the same way, because... He is, and now I know, Michael, you said earlier that you didn't understand this story. Basically, year over year, for the same 3 weeks that there was overlap where Conan did The Tonight Show last year, and I guess that was during May, this year, in 2010, Jay Leno's ratings are lower than what Conan O'Brien's ratings were for the same period last year. But in a way, I mean, he's beating Letterman. TV by the numbers pointed out, that doesn't really matter. What matters to NBC are a show's absolute ratings and their trend, which correlate to its advertising potential. On that basis, NBC cares about The Tonight Show's current ratings and their trend, which is down versus last year, not to Letterman's current ratings. So he's beating Letterman, but that doesn't matter.
And that's where they're wrong, because, yeah, it's always nice to look at trending and where they're going and where they were compared to a year ago and last week. But that's where you get in that whole box office mentality. Oh, my God, the box office is down this year compared to this week and last year. All that matters is, what audience are you bringing in? How big is your audience? And Letterman can have 50 million viewers. If you have 8 million viewers and you're making money, they don't care. And if you look at their charts and their trending and their this compared to last year at this time on a full moon, it's like, how many viewers does Jay Leno have? I looked and looked and couldn't figure it out from their little number thing. So Jay Leno, if he's pulling in 4 million viewers, they're happy. If he's not, then they're unhappy. But you know, the rest of it is all malarkey.
So what you're saying is, this is a very important story in the not important category.
Yes.
Okay, just checking. So then we should move on, because I think the next story is important. And for those of you keeping score at home, we are moving on to music. We really need little segue music, I think. That would prevent me from having to tell really corny jokes.
Well, we don't want segues anyway, right?
Oh, okay, fine.
Well, because you always complain about how hard it is to edit.
Yes, yes. Oh, there's no editing. We do this perfectly the very first time.
All right. This is a simple story. Make this simple and clear.
Okay, the simple story here is that Lollapalooza, which takes place in Chicago, it used to travel around the country and would play different cities. It was a concert a festival concert that was a roadshow. It would play in L.A., Chicago, New York, Dallas. Now it's always in Dallas. C3 presents it each year in Chicago, usually in August or very early September, right before they go on to produce Austin City Limits.
Is it in Dallas or Chicago? You just said both.
Well, it used to play in places like Dallas.
I understand, but you said it was playing this year in Dallas.
I'm sorry.
And then you said Chicago. I'm confused.
Okay. Let me untie everything and say that it is now taking place in Chicago every year on an annual basis, usually in late summer. And some of the bars and clubs and venues in Chicago have complained about the radius clauses that C3 includes in all of their artist contracts. Now, you might recall when we spoke about Coachella, a radius clause says that any artist performing at the festival cannot play within a certain area around the festival. Usually it's about 100, 150 miles. So if you're playing in a festival in Los Angeles, you might be able to play in San Diego, but you wouldn't be able to play in LA. In this case, what people are saying is that radius clause is 300 miles, and the time frame is 6 months before Lollapalooza, which is usually in August, and about 3 months after, which
is ridiculous.
Which, yeah, Chicago venues cannot actually book any bands because they are all basically, I don't want to say blacklisted, but the radius clause prevents them from doing that.
And they should be sued, and I hope they lose, because it's an incredibly onerous clause. And all they say in defense is, well, but we'll waive it if we don't think it's a big deal. It's like, yeah, you know, a month before or a few weeks before and after is reasonable to say, hey, if you're going to commit to our festival, we don't want you playing a big show the next night, you know, 10 feet away, because then people feel dumb buying the tickets. But, you know, 9 months? You can't play in a city because you're going to play their festival? It's insane. And to say, oh, but we'll waive it just means it's an idiotic clause to begin with. They got to make it more reasonable, and, you know, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, the radius area includes Detroit, Indianapolis, and Madison, Wisconsin. So,
yeah, give me a break.
It's very broad. And you're right. C3 said, you know, look, these are, you know, basically it's a conversation starter. You want to play someplace, you know, it's in there. You contact us, and we'll talk about it.
And yeah, and they just ask for the moon because that's their initial way. Like, give us your child. And then when you say, no, I'm not giving you my child, they're like, okay, give us an extra week. You know, I mean, it's just how they negotiate. But when you're asking for something so ridiculous from the get-go, that's stupid. That's just that creates bad will.
Well, Attorney General Lisa Madigan is not suing them, is investigating C3 and William Morris Endeavor, which is a co-owner of the festival, in fact. She is investigating them for antitrust. So it's not necessarily a lawsuit, but it is a very important investigation. And what I found interesting was Todd Martin's response to it. Todd Martin's, of course, we had on during right after Coachella. He joined us to talk about that festival. He had a blog post in Pop and Hist that said, so maybe Coachella's booking rules aren't so egregious after all. And he goes into all of the reasons why Coachella, which is in April, so the blackout clause or the radius clause really affects a winter season when most artists aren't touring anyway. And the fact that Golden Voice is owned by AEG, AEG owns most of the venues in LA, which is what would be included in the radius clause. So they have to kind of, you know, play not necessarily fast and loose, but they have to bend the rules a bit to book their own clubs if they want to have artists for their own clubs and have artists for Coachella.
Well, A, the idea that people don't tour in January, February, March, or April is bull, but also it's like, it just shows Coachella's hypocrisy as well. They're like, oh, well, we'll bend the rules so you can play in our clubs that we own as well as our festival. You know, yes. It's like, whatever.
Well, what do you expect? You know, I mean, these guys are all vertically integrated these days. You know, when you have Live Nation and you have AEG,
why they should not have been allowed to vertically integrate. That's why they should have been broken up and not allowed to do that. That's why it's bad for the world that Ticketmaster and these people are all swallowing each other up and they're all that's left.
Yeah, I mean, effectively, both Live Nation now and AEG, they own the venues, they manage the artists, and they sell the tickets. So they are writing contracts effectively for themselves.
Yeah, well, at least they're making money, hopefully, on these things. I know the Lil Affair is having trouble because Lil Affair just launched after a number of years, and now they've already canceled a number of dates that didn't work out on the tour because of slow ticket sales, including West Palm Beach, Tampa, Florida, Houston, Dallas, and no shock here, Birmingham, Alabama. I don't think Birmingham, Alabama is exactly the right market for Lilith Fair. I could have told them that.
Yeah, well, why do you think they're having problems selling tickets?
I don't know. It's a good lineup. This is the festival started by
Sarah McLachlan.
Sarah McLachlan, and she's brought it back after the mission. She's got a really good lineup of people. And I don't know. I think it's been away too long, maybe. Her album's just coming out, and I don't know whether it was marketing or what. But there's a good lineup of artists. They should have been able to pick up where they left off. I don't know whether they booked the right venues. Are the prices the same? Are they too high? I don't know. I don't know what's caused the problem here.
Well, maybe people are just festivaled out.
Sure, but this is a pretty different crowd. You know, Lil Affair was a pretty smart, you know, targeted festival. that really appealed to women who weren't going to a lot of other festivals, and they should have been able to reach their audience again. Maybe they just need to tweak it.
I think their audience is older.
Yeah, their audience is older. I mean, you've got Norah Jones, for Pete's sake. She's a jazz singer. She's a jazzy pop singer. So
she's one of the best-selling artists of the last decade.
Yeah, no, I'm not putting her down. I'm just saying it's.
But just because someone's a great-selling artist doesn't necessarily mean that their fans are people who go to festivals.
And festivals, I thought what Jeff Castellas, the head of Dangerbird Records, said about bands playing festivals as opposed to playing in a club, he was saying that playing in a club, you're converting people who are already converted. You'll play to 500 to 1,000 people, maybe, of people that are already fans. They know that you're playing the club, and they show up. Whereas at a festival, you're playing to 20,000, 30,000 fans who could be converted, as opposed to those who are already your fans. He says, just think about all the advertising that's done for Coachella around the world. If you're an up-and-coming band and you're on that bill, that's a prominent situation. Your name gets thrown around in a lot of places. And that's very true. I mean, a lot of people lose money playing Coachella, a lot of bands.
Yeah, I disagree. I think both are important. And I don't think you just find, you don't just have your base. You build a base by touring clubs. That's exactly, I pay money to see people in small places. I don't want to go to a festival. I don't want to go to Madison Square Garden. I want to see bands in a club where I can get up close. And that's where you build your fan base and you build up to bigger and bigger. That's the classic way to build an audience. It's not just the same people, because you pay $15, $17, you'll go see them. You'll take a chance because you're going to be 20 feet away and it's fun. And that's how you build an audience. And you move to slightly bigger venues and bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's how you build a career. So the idea that festivals are better than clubs is ridiculous, I think. They're both, it can be a great advantage to be in a festival. But when you're a young act, being listed at the bottom of a poster is not helping you. Being in a club and building up fans who become passionate about you, that matters a lot more.
I don't know. I'd have to disagree a little bit. But let me ask you this, Michael. If you had the chance to see Prince Charles of England at a festival, would you go?
No, I would go to Shea Stadium, because that's where I saw Prince William throw out the first pitch of the baseball game on Saturday. That was exciting.
Really?
He makes sense there. Prince Charles at Glastonbury, I don't know.
Yeah, what you're referring to, Michael, is that Prince Charles of England was at the Glastonbury Festival, which takes place in England over the weekend, and I guess he was seen on one of the main stages right before the festival began, and the crowd started cheering for him, and this is kind of a nothing story, but I just found it funny. And the organizer, Michael Evis, said his event had finally got the Royal Seal of Approval in its 40th year. That was kind of funny.
Prince William is much better looking. But anyway.
I guess we should move on to digital media, which is becoming its own segment in our show. Have you guys noticed that?
I love it.
Well, this week in digital media, what do you think we're going to talk about? I mean, something pretty big happened.
I don't know. Let me Google it. See what happened big this week.
You know, when you do
it
that.
On YouTube?
Okay. So, yes, that's what we're talking about. Google bought YouTube back in 2006, 2000, well, I think it was 2006, 2007. Viacom then immediately sued Google for placing all of this copyrighted content, like The Daily Show, on YouTube. And Google was saying, what? It's not us. It's our users. We can't prevent it. And they started taking down all of this copyrighted content. Now, as you mentioned, Michael, despite incriminating emails that show Google execs knew there was copyrighted material illegally posted on YouTube, which, of course, they own, a judge ruled that YouTube is, in fact, protected under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, just like internet providers. YouTube was ruled to be simply a quote-unquote pipe, a place where individuals could post and were responsible for what they posted, as long as YouTube showed good faith in working with media companies to fight piracy. Google is thrilled, Viacom is appealing, and this will probably go all the way to the Supreme Court. It's a really important ruling, I think.
And whose side are you on? Judging from the fact that you were kind of mocking YouTube, I'm assuming that you're on Viacom's side?
No, I'm on neither side. I mean, I think that in a way, it's good to have sites like YouTube around. I think that Viacom could use YouTube to better market its content.
They do use YouTube to market their content. That's the irony here.
Yes. And I would have to say I'm more on YouTube's side than Viacom's side. By a long shot, actually.
Me too. I don't even think Viacom's got a case. YouTube is a pipe for this kind of thing. It's safe harbor. And what, is YouTube going to sit there and monitor every single video that goes up? There's just no way.
Well, you said something very important.
It's like asking phone companies to monitor every phone call. Or, yeah. You know, you just can't do it.
And actually, YouTube did do a very good job once they kind of knew that this was going to be an issue and that these media companies, starting with Viacom, weren't going to just lie down and let people post copyrighted content on YouTube. They created a program that automatically takes content down that is deemed copyrighted, and they kind of digitally fingerprint it, and when it's uploaded, they check it against what content owners of copyrighted content have submitted, and if it checks out, they will pull that content down.
Yeah, and they're pretty responsible about it. I've had a lot of experience with it.
Yeah, I mean, they will take content down. They will err on the side of caution. Let's put it that way. So I was kind of glad to see this this ruling come down in Google's favor. I mean, $1 billion. And I think Google's statement says it all. They said it is, quote, an important victory not just for us, but also for the billions of people around the world who use the web to communicate and share experiences with each other, end quote. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very true. This is not just a ruling for Google. It's a ruling for any website that has user-generated content.
Yeah, I completely agree. This was a massive ruling. I actually doubt it will go all the way to the Supreme Court. I don't think the Supreme Court wants to be responsible for a ruling like that.
Yeah, I'm just saying I wouldn't be surprised if it goes all the way. I mean, Viacom has a lot of money.
Well, it's just a matter of whether they think there's some lower court ruling to overturn or an issue that hasn't been dealt with. You know, it's very complicated. Why? It'll go higher for sure. It'll get appealed, no question.
Yeah, because it's a big deal.
Oh, segue.
Yeah.
Just when we said we weren't doing segues, I try to segue us into our lightning round, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we talk about all of the top entertainment headlines of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story of the week is about Peter Jackson. Michael Fleming of Deadline Hollywood says Peter Jackson is set to direct the two-part movie The Hobbit. But Harry Knowles quotes insider quote-unquote Derek, who is clearly Jackson himself, that nothing has changed, and yes, they're working out details in case it does happen, but he's still hoping to find someone else to helm it. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, this is a very big deal.
I think it's a big deal, too. I loved the back and forth with Harry Knowles of Ain't It Cool News acting as the voice of reason and saying, Michael Fleming, where are your sources? And he's slapping back at him with Peter Jackson. But, you know, it's a big deal that there's so much attention for this movie because The Lord of the Rings was so big. I'm so excited about it, and I can't wait to figure out who does it. I'd love it if Peter Jackson does it, but obviously he doesn't want to, or he would have said yes ages ago.
Or they don't think that they can come to – he's worried that they can't come to a deal, and he doesn't want his fans to think that he's sold out.
And the studio wants an A-list director, and Chris Nolan and Steven Spielberg and a ton of other A-list directors are all on other projects. So, you know –
well, none of them were offered the job.
No. No, that's true. That is
no, no, no. I mean, you're naming people who are working. No, that's not the point. The point is – you know, he wanted Guillermo del Toro to do it. That fell out because the problem is the finances. That's the problem. Not that Peter Jackson is asking for too much money. They'll give him the moon. The problem is the whole complication of the financiers and MGM collapsing. And they've got a tight schedule and they want to keep it going. And it looks like he's going to have to step in even though he doesn't want to.
They wouldn't give him the moon.
They gave him the moon the last time. Of course they give him the moon. It's $1 billion.
But you know how many moons he probably asked for this time around?
That's not the sticking point. If he wanted to do the movie, he would have been doing it 3 years ago. They would have said yes to him. He was their first choice. They would love for him to say yes. He's always the one they would want to make. He is not the problem here. I mean, the money is not the problem here. If he wanted to do it, he'd be doing it.
I disagree. Moving on.
Well, our next topic is about two people who you might remember from the 80s. 80s pop idols Tiffany and Debbie Gibson are together again for the first time. Not in a nostalgic concert, but on Sci-Fi, or Syfy, as I like to call it. The pop stars, both of whom hit number one in their teens, are starring in the TV movie Megapython vs. Gatoroid, the latest in a string of enjoyably cheesy sci-fi Saturday night monster movies. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop? And who did you like more, Tiffany or Debbie Gibson?
I was sort of a Tiffany girl, but only because she was redhead. I think this is a big whoop, but I do think it's pretty awesome.
Michael.
It's a big whoop, of course, but Debbie Gibson is my favorite because she wrote, produced, and performed her songs while Tiffany's only hit was a cover.
You're saying her only hit was a cover. You broke up there a little bit, but here's a little known fact about Tiffany. Who was the first person to ever write a news story about Tiffany?
Sperling Reich.
How did you know? How did you know that?
Why else would you ask us this?
That's unbelievable. You're a genius.
For who and in what context?
Oh, I wrote it for the Teenage View, and it was because Universal was like, oh, you're kind of young, and you might like this teeny bopper girl who's playing malls throughout the summer. Why don't you interview
her? I was on top of the Jonas Brothers really early on. Oh, wait.
Whoa, watch how you're putting that.
That's a sure sign that we should move on to our next story.
I didn't mean that.
Moving on to Helen Mirren. After photos of Helen Mirren looking fit in a bikini went viral on the internet, the queen of acting decided to one-up herself. The 65-year-old Oscar winner disrobed for a sexy but discreet nude shoot in a bathtub for New York Magazine to promote her new flick, Love Ranch. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
You know, I think it's a big deal for geriatrics. Good for her. And yet, I never really think that women need to pose nude. I don't care how old they are.
Michael?
Okay. Wow, Karen changed my mind. I mean, I hate it when young women have to tart themselves up for coverage in the press. But actually, for Helen Mirren, I think it's great. And it's very classy.
Moving on, usually it's a family film that, like Shrek or How to Train Your Dragon, or teen cult like Twilight, that results in a deluge of tie-ins. But Julia Roberts' new drama, Eat, Pray, Love, based on the best-selling novel, featured on Oprah, is giving them a run for their money. Look for jewelry, perfume, organic food, t-shirts, tea, and more, because nothing says spiritual fulfillment like a movie merchandise tie-in. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal because I think it can spoil the movie a bit. I mean, perfume tie-ins to Eat, Pray, Love, it's completely wrong for the movie.
Karen?
I think this is a big whoop. It'd be a big deal if we could, like, point a laser beam at the screen and order it while we were watching it.
Ooh. That's a really good idea, actually.
They wish.
Our next story is about John Lasseter of Pixar fame. God is my co-pilot, but when it comes to the Pixar film sequel Cars 2, director Brad Lewis's co-pilot is now Pixar founder John Lasseter. Lasseter directed the original Cars, which was one of the worst-grossing movies for Pixar, but proved wildly successful in merchandise, $5 billion and counting. Lewis was making his directorial debut, but needed help, and now Lasseter is working alongside him. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop? I don't know why we're asking Karen about an animated film.
Big whoop.
Michael.
I say it's a big deal, though there's a long tradition of two people working on an animated film as co-directors, so it should not, upset Lewis too much, but you know, when you're the sole guy and then they step in, it's never a good sign.
Well, I think it's a big deal because right now the creative head of Disney Animation and Pixar Animation is John Lasseter, and if he's off kind of doing a film, where is the creative direction of those two divisions of Disney? I mean, I hope
he can multitask.
I hope
so. Yeah, I'm sure there are other creative people there.
Tupac's Ode to His Mother, Dear Mama, joins Tunes by Public Enemy and Grandmaster Flash as only the third hip-hop tune to make it to the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. Other new entries include R.E.M.'s Radio Free Europe, Little Richard's Tutti Frutti, Willie Nelson's Red-Headed Stranger, and The Little Engine That Could, as narrated by Paul Wing. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
I have to confess, I know nothing about the National Recording Registry, so big deal?
Michael?
Even when you were a crack fiend, mama, you were, never mind. I won't try and sing too bad.
Oh my God, you are so whack.
I thought it was dope.
It's a big deal. It's a big deal that hip hop. I mean, even the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is slow to acknowledge hip hop, so it's important.
The Catcher in the Rye is going to become a movie, except it's not. In classic British tabloid fashion, The Telegraph ran a breathless article saying that The Catcher in the Rye was on the verge of becoming a movie. Why? Because Salinger died in a year when estate taxes weren't applied and maybe his estate wasn't that big. And by the way, back in 1957, he wrote a letter speculating that maybe someday after he died, his wife or children might sell the rights. In other words, no reason at all. In the very last line of the article, The Telegraph finally admits that a spokesperson said there are no plans to sell the rights to the book and that Hollywood may have to wait nearly a century for the book to enter the public domain. So The Catcher in the Rye is going to become a movie in 2085. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Thank you, Telegraph.
Karen?
I think it's pretty clearly a big whoop. But talk to me again in 2085.
Hold on, I'm just putting that down in my date book.
Okay. Yeah. Paul, don't forget to add the Academy Awards date too.
Oh yeah, okay, thanks. Harry Potter isn't going anywhere. After part one of the Deathly Hallows opens this fall, actor Daniel Radcliffe hits Broadway for a revival of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And then comes part two and the grand finale of Potter, followed by his starring role in a new film version of the classic anti-war book All Quiet on the Western Front, written by Eric Remarque, if I'm not mistaken. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Is what a big deal or big whoop? That he's working?
Daniel Radcliffe works. Headline. No, that Radcliffe is going to star in a remake of All Quiet on the Western Front.
Big whoop.
Michael?
That's a big deal. I always thought Hermione would be the only one to survive.
Oh, brother.
Yikes, that's terrible.
Well, apparently Sylvester Stallone is surviving. Yo, Adrian! I mean, yo, Gotti! Sylvester Stallone is planning to star in a film based on the mobster, you, John Gotti, and the relationship between the Dapper Don and his son. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop. Why glorify him? Why do a movie about him? Who cares?
Karen?
I don't know. I mean, if it's done well, it could mean something for Sylvester Stallone's career. I'd say there's a possibility of it being a big deal, but right now it's a big whoop. Talk to me in 2085.
Is The Office closing shop? Steve Carell, star of the U.S. version of The Office, says when his contract is up this May, he'll be saying goodbye. Though he thinks it's time to go, Carell insists that even after 7 seasons, the show could continue without him. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop.
Michael?
It's a big deal. The show was never a big commercial hit, but it's critically acclaimed, and God willing, they'll end it when he goes.
Yeah, I mean, no show has been able to survive a star like that leaving.
You've got Jim and Pam. It can survive with Jim and Pam.
Oh, that's true. Maybe, yeah.
But the show is so done creatively. They should definitely end it.
No, I totally agree.
Well, I'm a huge fan of the show, like I was a huge fan of Scrubs, and I think with Steve Carell leaving, it's going to lose quite a bit. But that wraps up, I think, how many of these stories did we do in Big Deal or Big Whoop? Like 20? That was a lot of news for 1 week. And we have a lot of email this week, too. Listener email. So thank you very much for writing in. We have one from our good friend in New York, I believe, Aaron Rich. He writes, "Hi, guys. I think it's an interesting story about how Rolling Stone is being run like a magazine in 1985 and not 2010. Somehow they think that Lady Gaga's machine gun bra is more important than a major exclusive interview with the head of the ill-fated war in Afghanistan, in which he trashes everyone, including the president, vice president, the mission, and his troops. To some degree, at least he paints them in a bad way, that is, the troops. This reminds me of how in the past you guys have talked about how old media is dumb and need to learn to work in the modern media world with Twitter and Facebook and the interwebs. Love the show, Aaron." And, you know, I have to say I was a little surprised at how Rolling Stone got scooped by Time Magazine. Even they, you know, Time Magazine got a copy of the Rolling Stone article and posted it. I mean, they just really did a bad job of handling it. But I also think that, you know, old media isn't necessarily dumb. They're just trying to figure it out, and they've really got to move a lot faster.
Well, I definitely agree Rolling Stone's dumb. I mean, they should have been the portal for music and have introduced new artists and videos and songs, you know, 20 years ago, and they blew it. But I initially disagreed with Aaron, and I thought, because I think he's talking about who's on the cover of the magazine to a degree, you know, and Lady Gaga's on the cover. I don't think you're going to have, you know, a general on the cover. That's going to be horrible. But
I know,
as far
I,
as
I guess
they,
the story was about General Stanley McChrystal and how he told this.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's been since dismissed, properly so. Because you can talk about, like, you can diss your, you know, your bosses back in Washington to your guys, but not to the media. That's ridiculous. But
what an idiot. Talk about dumb.
Yeah, no, it was very dumb, absolutely. But the way that they did let it leak out and all that shows dumbness. I also think, though, on a bigger issue, Rolling Stone has always had really good journalism, and I think they're still seen as just a music man. They really need to reposition themselves as, you know, like the Atlantic, not the Atlantic, but a young, hip Atlantic, where you get great articles about all sorts of things, and I don't think they really present themselves that way very well. They really need to rebrand themselves as a source of really great journalism, which they are. You know, they've got great economic news coverage, thanks to Matt Taibbi. They've got really good political stories like this, and they're still just like the place of Lady Gaga. You know, you don't think of Rolling Stone and go there for that, but they really need to work on their image.
And now's the time to do it, which is kind of what Aaron's saying.
Yes, now is the time to do it, especially since they have had one great news story after another. And, you know, not necessarily music related. These are
at all. No, that's their weakest part.
I know. That's very true. But Aaron, thank you for writing in. If you want to write in, the email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Okay, that brings us to our inside baseball segment for this week. And this week, we're going to be joined by Matea Gold, who is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. She works out of the New York Bureau. And if you've been reading the LA Times like I do each day, because it winds up at the end of my driveway, you'll know that Matea has been doing quite a job covering television. There's at least one story a week where I read it and go, wow, how did they find that out? So, Matea, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to be here.
Now, yesterday when I went to the end of my driveway, I picked up the Sunday LA Times, all 15 inches of it, and when I ripped open the plastic and read the top story, upper right-hand corner, it was a story that you and Richard Verrier, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, but you and Richard Verrier wrote that story, and it was about children working in reality series.
Correct.
What was the impetus for starting a month-long investigation into the laws and rights that children have when performing or working in reality television?
Yeah, well, as many things start, or maybe they don't start, I actually got the idea watching The Real Housewives of New Jersey. In the premiere episode of this season, there was a scene in which one of the housewives was driving in a car and was ranting and raving about going to confront her rivals, and her children were in the car, and she seemed completely emotionally overwrought and almost unstable. And I thought, how is it they're allowing her children to not only be in this situation, but they're filming it for entertainment? So Richard and I started talking about looking into what regulations exactly govern children working in reality television, and found out there almost none do.
You spent a month examining the public records of all of these shows, and you found that 11 shows filming in 8 states had not filed paperwork to hire the minors in the first place. And regulators in California, Florida, Georgia, and Virginia are now looking into whether production companies violated any child labor laws. But as you point out, they probably didn't.
It's an incredibly murky issue. What we've basically found is that children who appear on reality television shows fall into this legal gray zone. Producers consider them participants, not performers or employees. And so child labor laws have rarely been applied to these shows. And the federal law that governs children working has an exemption for performers. So it's really up to the states to regulate. And there's not a single state that explicitly includes reality television in its entertainment child labor laws. So what we found is it's really piecemeal. In some cases, the states interpret it to be a reality television show to be like a scripted show. But for another show, they won't interpret it the same way. Regulators are confused. Producers say they're confused. And in the meantime, children are working without any kind of oversight about how many hours they work, about how much they get paid, if they get paid, without anyone on set to make sure they're not exposed to dangerous situations.
Well, Matea, it was a fascinating article, and you raised a lot of questions about whether there should be teachers on the set, whether they should be paid, whether any money that's made from their participation in the show should be set aside for them. And really, money is what it's all about, isn't it? Because this is a much bigger issue for reality TV. They want to do these shows on the cheap, and so they're non-union, and they try to keep everything off the books as much as possible. They use editors in non-union ways so they can get them out there and get them cheap and get them done without having to pay a lot of extra money. And if they followed a lot of rules and had to have teachers on the set and have the kids only film for a certain number of hours a day, it'd be a lot more expensive to do these shows, wouldn't it?
Right. And that's the assertion that the Hollywood guilds have been making for a long time now, that these shows are so cheap to produce because they are basically circumventing the rules that scripted shows have to follow. That we've obviously seen a big fight between the guilds and reality television over writers, whether they're unionized or not. And now we're really seeing that children, who are increasingly kind of the focus of these shows, you know, there's all of these shows about families with multiples. These kids are really being used as entertainment, and there's no one really paying attention to whether they're being taken care of in the process.
And none of those kids are being paid. Like John and Kate's plus 8, they are not paid at all?
Well, it really varies. I was told that none of the children on the Housewives franchise, which airs on Bravo, are being paid. Their mothers are being paid, but you know, it's unclear whether those kids will ever see any of that money, even though they appear on the show. The children on what is now Kate Plus 8 are getting money that is being set aside in a trust for them. That was the result of a investigation that the Department of Labor in Pennsylvania conducted. That was the resolution to their investigation this spring. They found that that show should have been complying with child labor laws. But it's really unclear whether shows on and it children on any other shows are getting any forms of compensation.
This story breaks, actually, when I can't remember her name, the Sunderland daughter who was sailing around the world.
Right.
Was I guess she ran into some trouble and her boat was demasted and she had to be rescued. And then shortly after that, the LA Times broke the story about the fact that the father was entering into a deal or was negotiating a deal to appear in a reality show with the kids.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think one of the things we've heard from a lot of child advocates in reporting this story is the reason they feel so strongly there needs to be specific laws on the books that govern these shows is that oftentimes the parents who choose to have their children on these programs, there's a lot of questions about their judgment in the process of even doing that. And the Sunderland case, I think, speaks to that. I mean, you can judge their parenting skills, whether it was smart to let her go around the world, but I think people are becoming increasingly cynical about parents putting their children on these programs and whether it's a good idea to begin with. So if you have a parent who's willing to put their children on camera, it kind of raises a question whether they are necessarily also going to be limiting the amount of time they're on camera and assuring other restrictions.
And some would say if a parent puts their kid on a reality show, they are by definition not showing good judgment necessarily.
I was just going to say, too, what about that show Kid Nation? What was the fallout from that? Because that's when people really started first talking about it, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah, Kid Nation happened 3 years ago. And that's kind of the epitome of the clash between child labor laws and reality television shows. I mean, they put 40 kids, sequestered them on a ranch in New Mexico with no contact with their parents. They had no work permits. CBS and the production company asserted that the children were essentially doing the equivalent of sleepaway camp, so they didn't have to pay them a wage.
Right.
And actually there was no one on set externally from New Mexico's, you know, film and TV commission or from their Department of Labor to monitor conditions. And a girl got burnt in the face with grease. Several other children drank a container that had bleach in it. And so I think that really brought a lot of these issues to a head. And in the aftermath of that, the rules in New Mexico were really tightened. But a lot of states don't even have, we found that 17 states don't have any rules on the books that govern children working in entertainment.
Now, you spoke with several of the networks, Bravo, where the Real Housewives seems to be in every city. I think they have a Real Housewives.
Right.
They said that they try to ensure that children's hours of participation were being monitored and that they didn't miss school and that all children, and this is a quote, all children participate only with parental consent and involvement. Do you think that now that you're contacting them and that this is getting some attention, this issue is getting some attention in the media, that these networks are beginning to think about, gee, we're really going to have to handle this. We're really going to have to think about how we move forward.
I know that our inquiries definitely provoked a lot of internal, if not soul searching, internal record examination. I mean, the networks obviously, first of all, want to make sure they're not going to be liable for anything. So, their first assertion to us was, we follow all, and we asked our production companies to follow all applicable rules. But now that I think this is getting the attention of, state legislators and BAFTAs even trying to push for a federal law, I think that could hopefully bring some reform about. I mean, the tricky thing, to note some of the production companies' concerns on this, they find sometimes when they call these states, the departments of labor don't even know if they need a permit or not. So, one producer said to us, have you ever tried to get a permit for something you didn't need? I mean, it is very difficult when the bureaucracy can't give you any kind of clarity on that. So I think what we heard from all parties involved was that there needs to be more transparency and a clearer definition of exactly what applies to these children.
Well, I don't think it was soul-searching from their network so much as damage control. But
That's probably a better way to put it.
Needed is regulation by the states, because you can't ask them to do that themselves because there's an inherent conflict of interest. But it's a really good story, and I wondered when you found out, I don't know what the internet equivalent would be, but for us, it's A1. It was on the front page of the newspaper, which means they really love the story. When did you find out it was going to be on A1? How does that come about, where they get more and more excited about what you're doing?
Well, when Richard and I started looking into it, we quickly realized that there was going to be a great story here because the state regulators we spoke to made it pretty clear they didn't even really know what the full picture was. So as we talked to our editors all along, the hope was that this could be a front page story, but we got word over the weekend that they definitely wanted it out front. And then I didn't realize it was going to leave the paper until Sunday morning. So that was a nice vote of confidence from the folks at our office.
Well, Matea, thank you very much for joining us. Matea Gold with the Los Angeles Times. Now, do you have a Twitter account we can plug?
I do. Thanks so much. Yeah, it's twitter.com/MateaGold, one word, MateaGold. My pleasure. Great to join you guys.
Thank you. We will place a link to your story in the show notes.
Thanks a lot.
Wonderful. Thanks. My pleasure.
Bye.
What I loved in the story was she had a quote from an advocate for child actors and children in child labor situations, Paul Peterson, who they didn't even identify, but that's the actor from the Donna Reed Show, who's developed an activist career trying to help get laws and regulations on the books to protect child actors, because obviously Hollywood has a long history going back to Jackie Cooper of kids being taken advantage of, whether they're working on films or television or now in reality TV.
The Jackie Cooper story is, of course, a well-known story. And I guess even Gary Coleman said that his mother spent most of his money from different strokes. And that came out.
I thought it was Coogan. Isn't it Coogan? Coogan's Law?
Oh, Jackie Coogan.
Coogan, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Thank you for an instant correction. That's, I like that. That's pretty good.
Well, if Gary Coleman's mom did that, she broke the law.
Yeah, well, you know, that's fine. But he has now passed away and, you know, he doesn't really help.
Well, but there are a lot better laws in place because of Jackie Coogan. I don't know how that happened. But usually nowadays you don't hear as many bad stories about child actors on television or movies. But now you see there's a whole new problem in reality. So that was a really good story.
Yeah, it's really strict, though, in scripted television. I mean, it's really strict.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
Well, we will place a link to that story, as I mentioned, in the show notes, which can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you will find ways to contact us. As I mentioned before, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. And you can leave us a voicemail toll-free, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Our website is also where you'll find links to all of our social networking accounts, Facebook, YouTube, Flickr, I don't know, we have Twitter. And I'm sure once once Google Me starts, because they're rumored to start a little Facebook competitor, we'll probably have one of those too. Now, the music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found, besides on a street corner, which apparently has a lot of chirping birds near it. So
beautiful.
He can be found on Twitter, @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. That's also the domain name for his website, where links to all of his writings from the Huffington Post to the Daily News can be found, michaelgiltz.com. Karen Woodward has a website, karenwoodwardonline.com. Her Twitter account is @KarenWoodward. No, sorry, it's @Karen_Woodward. I can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. That's where some of my writing resides. I'm also on Twitter, @Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.